Hello, I'm Harriet Tramer, and I am your host for Reaching for the Gold. I hope you will join me for this program when it is broadcast every other Tuesday afternoon at this time. People often need to be surrounded by a circle of love as they age. They might benefit from the support of caregivers, and medical attention can be essential. But these simple statements bring to the fore more questions than they answer. Who supports the caregiver? What type of support do they even need? And while it is certain that older people, as is the case with virtually everyone else, require medical attention, some things are much less clear. Precisely what support should this care assume? Do they need care that differs from that delivered to people in other age groupings? Are they more likely than our younger people to recover without any medical intervention at all, if given time? Does their resilience have to be taken into account? Nobody can answer these questions with any certainty. They are far too complex for that to be possible. But today's guest will help us gain some valuable insights. Our first guest is Mark Gibbons, Program Manager for the Caregiver Action Network, which offers a wide range of support to family caregivers. And our second guest is Dr. Leslie Kernison, a geriatrician in private practice who has made the rather unusual decision to forego Medicare, charging her patients on a self-pay basis. Mark, thank you for the show. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
To begin, we're talking about caregivers. What exactly do you mean by a caregiver? If I have elderly parents and they're doing fine, but I come over there once a week and help them go shopping, or I take them to the doctor or something of that nature, help fix something in the house, am I a caregiver or am I just a good family member, a good daughter? How do you distinguish, or is there no distinguishing?
You are an actual family caregiver. Now, there isn't really an actual distinction between the two, especially in different cultures. Some people in different cultures feel that it is their job and duty as a son or daughter to go ahead and do these things with the elderly parent. But an actual caregiver can be one that just helps with just menial things, going by mom or dad's house to help them go shopping because maybe mom can't drive or dad can't drive, helping them get to their doctor's appointments, helping make calls about different things. All these things are actual caregiving tasks. Now, there are various stages of being a caregiver. Now, what you're describing is a very low stress level. But there are some caregivers that are doing it 24/7, have to help with medication, changing different bandages, watching somebody with Alzheimer's. It varies.
Now, you say low stress. Mm-hmm. I understand what you said, and I understand that what you're expressing is a continuum. But if I am working, I have children, and maybe even I'm also going to school, that's not so low stress to have to also go once
a
week.
No, it's not. You are correct. Well, then in that case, when you have all those factors, then yes, you are at a very high stress level. On our website, we have a couple of categories that one of people fall into. One, it could be, I just realized I am an actual family caregiver now. One could be, I have been a family caregiver for years. The other one is, I live far away, and now I am on the actual caregiving team. And lastly, I have a job, and I am also an actual caregiver for a loved one. So those are the four categories people usually fall into. What you just described is a very common factor. A lot of people are what they would call sandwich generation. They may have younger children at home, but yet they may be checking on mom or dad. And so it's very tough, and plus they're also juggling a job. And that is very stressful. So we always explain to all the actual family caregivers that they need to take care of themselves first, because if they don't do that, then they cannot take care of the loved ones, whether it be the younger children, the older parents, or even themselves or their spouse. So it's very important that you focus and try to find resources that are going to help you manage your time better.
Okay, now, you talk about the stress people feel. I'm going to give you an example, because it's probably pretty typical. Woman, 45, two children in school, mm-hmm. a job at least 30 hours a week. Her parents are about 70. They're starting to need some help. And she's a realist, so she figures they'll need even more and more in the not-distant future. She is feeling stress. How can that stress be relieved?
Well, there are a couple of ways, Harriet. One is for her to talk to somebody, whether it is the other spouse in the family, or it could be other siblings, or it could be a natural support group. It doesn't have to be an in-person one. It could be a virtual. A lot more people are starting to feel more comfortable with virtual support groups because they feel they can open up and ask more questions freely. And so all these are things that they can do to help relieve some of the tension. Ask people, hey, I'm in this boat. Has anybody experienced this before? And you'd be shocked at all the wonderful answers you get on these online support groups. Someone say, hey, you're not alone. This is what I've tried. You know, Dad is starting to get Alzheimer's and develop it faster than we thought. And he keeps trying to go to his car. So what someone has done is taken the battery out of the vehicle so they don't have to worry about him driving. And that works. And so people share these various ideas. Or, you know, what about trying to get my mom to take her medicine? She's an Alzheimer's patient. How can I physically get her to take it, you know, put it in peanut butter, do other things like this? These people help each other. It's communication is a key to help relieve the stress that this person's going to have. They have to talk to people. Find out who can help them. Don't be afraid to ask for help. And I know, and you know, Harry, that it's hard to ask for help. I have a hard time doing it. But they have to at this stage.
Okay, now let's go back on some of this. You were saying, I have a problem, my parent shouldn't be driving, or I feel they shouldn't be driving, they are, what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
All right, now, when I hear that, my head clicks in, okay, take away the car battery.
Mm-hmm.
They try to start the car, it's obviously not going to start. I'm going to give you a little bit of a slider here.
Okay.
When I hear that, okay, fine. When I am in that situation, that may be some of the roughest thing I ever had to face. Maybe I know that my parent depends upon their driving. That's their sense of independence, of getting around. Saying you can't do that, wow, that's rough. That's
rough.
Now, can a virtual caregiving support group where somebody is typing in, okay, take away the car battery,
mm-hmm.
and it just sounds like, okay, you got a present, here's how you assemble it, can it really help that person?
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes, Harriet, what a person needs is to bring in some outside help in a situation like that. What other people have done is they've called somebody that maybe Dad really respects, whether it is a close family friend, it could be a minister, could be a doctor, but an opinion that father really respects. Are you coming in down? You all sit down and say, look, Dad, this is what I've realized. I don't think that you should be driving. And so here believes me that, you know, that this isn't good and this is why. And he's probably more apt to listen to that person that he respects than a child, because the child should always go to the parent for answers and, you know, and those types
mm-hmm.
of things. So it's kind of hard. So, but if they bring in an expert, or, I mean, just somebody that they really feel comfortable with, or someone that they really respect their actual judgment, that helps. That really does help a lot.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Now, has caregiving... You have been in the business of supporting caregivers for how long?
Well, we have been in the business of doing that for over 15 years now.
Now, how has this whole situation changed over the last 15 years. I'm sure it's changed. What are some ways in which this has happened?
Well, the way that it is changing is more in regards to the role of the actual caregiver, because now we have what everyone has called the actual silver tsunami coming. You know, so we have all these baby boomers that are now wanting to age in place, and they aren't, and they feel a lot more stronger, independent. Plus, people are actually living longer, you know, and that's just a fact. And so what has adjusted is that the actual caregiver now is assuming a role. A lot more people are actually being sandwich generation, like we spoke earlier. They have younger kids at home. They're kind of monitoring their parent. But now we also have the key thing of actual called technology now that has come in to help the actual caregiver now. Now you have apps or medical devices or all these things that we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
Before, when you had an Alzheimer's patient, you didn't have a security system at home that lets you know when a door or window opened, you know, so that'll allow you to work. You had to physically stay there or hire somebody to stay there with mom or dad.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have all these electronic devices that kind of help you keep your job, you know, to keep you employed, but also help you with your job as being a caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily the best answer, but at least it helps.
I understand.
And go ahead.
But if somebody is very good with technology, okay, mm-hmm. plug this in, blip, 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 couldn't that technology, sure, it helps, and I understand you're not talking about optimum, you're talking about practical. I realize that. But couldn't that potentially add to somebody's stress if they aren't real accustomed to technology?
Oh, sure they could. Sure it could. I mean, you know, because let's just face it, technology is a scary thing, and a lot of the people as we get older, even myself, I still have problems trying to program, one of these DVD players.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, technology is also scary, but unfortunately, that's the way we're going.
Everything
is just getting there. And what we've noticed now more and more is before we had a lot of actual caregivers that would want stuff printed material. Now the request from actual caregivers, you know, people 60 and older, say, can you send it electronically to me?
Mm-hmm.
So we're noticing that a lot more of the of those senior centers, the churches, all these support groups that these seniors go to, are now trying to get them plugged in electronically, and they're trying to establish email. So more and more people are finding out that the internet and technology is really a pretty good thing to have. But like I said, we have noticed that people now are asking for more and more things online, electronically, instead of asking for hard print.
Okay, when you talk about that, wonderful. I can do many things online. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about somebody who has to deal with kidney dialysis technology, mm-hmm. on that level, that's extraordinarily stressful.
Yeah,
and it's
sure
something
it
that certainly would not have been done 5 years ago.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. We have so many advances, but still, there is still the human factor involved in all this. And that person that is helping take care of that loved one still needs the training, still needs to understand what happens if the power goes out, what happens with this or that. So they still need the classes, still need the training, in-person training, but a lot of people are relying more and more on electronics or that type of information. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know what the answer is. I mean, there are still some people that are in rural America that don't have high-speed internet. They're still on dial-up. Some people
mm-hmm.
don't even have computers. So we have to send. There are so many different agencies out there that still have doctors or nurses that come and do house calls to come work with the family. And train who they need to train. There are various support groups that you can create, like you can create a village or a circle of friends that you invite in and go, look, please check this website, or please just call me every once in a while to see what kind of help I need. So people are starting to support, are starting to form groups, circles around them, whether it's through the church or through online programs like, let's say, Lots of Helping Hands or Sattering, or creating a village where you invite people in and you help each other. And whether it be, you know, hey, you know, I can't get out there and mow the lawn anymore, but you have a son that can come over. If he could do that, then maybe I can help send over a meal every other day or something. Or
now,
go ahead.
You're talking about when this is manageable. How do you know, or don't you know, when caring for this person at home, due to their mental or physical circumstances, simply is no longer manageable? Or don't you know? Does it have to reach some type of crisis? Does there have to be a fall, something of that nature, before you know that type of thing?
Harriet, I don't necessarily know what the exact answer is. I know when I speak to people, I always hear the same phrase. In my heart, I know, you know, that they can't do this by themselves anymore, or I can't do this by myself anymore. But because I'm the son or the daughter, I feel I need to. So I think people self-recognize, but it's hard for them to take that next step and ask that help. It's hard for someone to go, okay, Mom and Dad, I've been taking care of you, but I just physically cannot do that now. You both need me to lift you. You need me to do this, that, and I physically can't do this. So the best resource for me, the best way that I can help you, is to put you in an assisted living facility. And that's hard. People kind of know, and plus a doctor may tell you, he may start asking questions, go, hey, Harriet, you know, you're taking care of your mom. Have you noticed this, this, and this? Have you noticed that, you know, she's stumbling more? Have you noticed that forgetting medications? Is she having problems making it to the restroom in the evenings? These are all signs that the doctor's going to ask, the questions the doctor's going to ask you. Then you and the physician may have to have a talk and go, well, what do I do? What are the options? Sometimes if you go to like an area, a senior center that may have counselors, you can talk to them and say, hey, look, this is where I'm at. This is where I'm faced with. What do I do? How do I approach this situation with my parents? The same thing with those virtual support groups that I told you. Those people have, most of them have actually come to that role, to that scenario now, and how did you deal with it, or how do I deal with it? It is a tough one, and I'm not quite sure I have the right answer for you.
Mm-hmm. How was your group first formed? How did that happen?
What happened is our co-founder Suzanne Mintz's husband has he has MS, and she had a co-founder I think he had Parkinson's, and they actually lived on the same street, and they were talking one day, sharing stories about, you know, the problems they're having with trying to get care or the running to the doctors, and they said, hey, why don't we form a group that can help family caregivers find resources, whether it be respite, support groups, organizations in their community that can help relieve some of this burden so they could offer quality care for their loved one. And that's how the organization came about.
Give a list or help us to better understand what type of support your group does offer.
Okay. What we do is if you were to call here and you say, I live in Texas, I said, okay, Harriet, what part of Texas? You tell me the Houston area. I said, okay, well, let me look at my list. I have a volunteer that lives in Houston. I'll put you in contact with that volunteer, and they can let you know what kind of organizations or programs are in your area that can help you either with respite care or with counseling, or with support groups, or maybe in your state you have a special program in Houston that may allow some type of compensation for the caregiver to help stay at home to take care of that loved one. It always varies from community to community, county to county. There are different programs, different help groups. My My volunteer network is aware of various programs throughout the country in various communities that might be able to help you. If you feel comfortable going online, then you come to our website, and we have a bunch of online resources, such as a plugged-in toolkit, which will tell you what type of electronic devices that may be available in your area, like, let's say, a Philips Lifeline, those type of programs, or a security device, or maybe something that helps you monitor medication. We have other type of resources that may will find you a doctor's office checklist to help you create a list of, you know, when you go to a doctor's office, what are the questions that I should ask, or do you have an up-to-date medication checklist? We'll tell you how to create one of those, a patient file checklist, how to create those. All these things are online. Plus, all my volunteers know how to walk you through all these steps so you can be more knowledgeable when you speak to a healthcare professional. So those are the type of things that we offer.
Okay. We've been talking about a lot of things that are very hard to deal with. That's just part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a lot of what we're discussing, the elephant in the room, excuse me, but it's financial.
Exactly.
How can you help somebody who, wait a minute, I have to work. My parent, my whatever, my spouse, whatever, who needs care 24 hours a day. I have to work. I can't do that. Now, I don't want to put them in a nursing home. They may be mentally alert, but physically have some problems. But that seems to be my only option. Or I need help from Medicaid, and Medicaid will not pay for other than a nursing home. How can you help people deal with some of these very difficult dollars and cents matters? What advice can you give them?
Well, what we do is through one of our corporate partners, ALSIP, they have a program that helps with that type of planning, for financial planning. And they will let you know, have you thought about this, have you thought about that? But like you said, Medicaid right now is the only program that we're aware of. And it's not available in all states. But will, in some cases, help compensate the actual caregiver so you can stay at home. But again, this is very few and far between. Not all states offer it. Some do, some don't. But the financial aspect of it is the hardest one to answer. Even for us, all we can do is point you to an attorney, to a financial planner, those type of people that have dealt with those type of elder issues, because it is expensive. And I get calls almost daily, Harriet, of people that are just at the breaking point because they've used all their parents' money and now they're using all of theirs because the care that they had thought they were going to get has really exceeded the budget.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, do I keep working? I have to work or else I can't keep them, you know, in the nursing facility. But if I come home and take care of them, then I don't have any money to pay for my mortgage, my bills, my electricity. It's a tough one, and I don't know we have an answer for it. I'm not sure that Congress has developed an answer for it. We keep bringing it up. AARP and other organizations like that keep addressing that issue to the Congress, saying, hey, how do we help the family caregiver financially? Because this is a big burden, and I don't know the answer to that.
Well, one thing, which I'm sure you're very, very aware of, is even if you do work, mm-hmm. you may not be able to afford a nursing home without Medicaid, which is, as we know, not generous and not in ready supply, because they can cost $90,000 or more a year.
Oh, easily. So, I don't know what the answer is. We have struggled with that, trying to find solutions, and we just don't know what the answer is because, like I said, the costs keep going up higher. Nursing homes, the cost keeps going up higher. Insurance costs and different things that they keep telling us. And I just don't know how all these brand new the health laws are going to come into effect. We don't know. We're still trying to figure it out, like everybody else. How is all this health insurance reform and all those sort of things going to affect us? And we just don't have the answer. No one can give us a straight answer.
Where would you like to see your organization moving? What would you like to see it offer on a realistic level that it is not presently offering?
I guess we would really like to offer more one-on-one help. Try to put people more and more with volunteers in their community. I only have 106 volunteers. I have about one, sometimes two in each state, but like in Texas, I only have one, and that's in Houston. I would love to have, be able, our organization would love to have a volunteer in each major city that we can actually help these people better. Right now, we just don't have the resources. It is a volunteer program, and people that have either are in the health field or have been a caregiver and say, you know, I did this for 15 years, I'm done, but I think I can help others. Well, then they contact us and they become a volunteer. But for us, I think being able to offer more hands-on help would be where we want to be.
And if somebody wants to get in contact with your organization, how can they do that?
They can either contact me by phone, which is 301-942-6430, or they can send us an email at info@caregiveraction.org and let us know that they're interested in volunteering, or even if they have a problem as a caregiver and they want help, they can just send an email to that, and I check the emails every day. They come across 24/7 to me, and I will respond and say, this is what I have in your ear, or if you're looking to volunteer to become one of those resources, I will get you the right paperwork, and we'll get you trained, and we'll go from there.
And your website is?
Caregiveraction.org.
Mark, thank you very, very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Mary.
And I'm sure it's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Dr. Knudsen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I will start right off with what most might be the most difficult question. You're a geriatrician. What does that mean? How is that different than medicine for anybody?
Okay. Well, just as we developed in medicine the specialty of pediatrics several decades ago, because the profession realized that medicine had to be practiced a little bit differently in children. So we also have the specialty of geriatrics, which means the practice of medicine that's specially tailored towards the unique needs of aging adults. And so a geriatrician is a physician trained first in either internal medicine or family practice, who then does some extra training in geriatrics through a fellowship. That's right now an extra year of training after residency. And that focuses on developing a skill set that allows the physician to better meet the needs of aging adults for their health care.
Okay, now, when you say aging adults, these day and age, there's a lot of people, 65, even 70, who would say, huh, me? I'm in great health. I don't need any special consideration. How would you define an aging adult? Anybody over a certain age, or how would you define that?
Well, you could certainly say that all of us are aging, you know, and many of us start noticing a little bit some changes, even, you know, after the age of 30. We might feel like we weren't the way we were when we're 20. Generally, people who are in their 60s, unless they have lots of health problems and have started to develop disabilities, do not need a geriatrician. There's no exact age cutoff, but at a certain point, people have had enough age-related changes to their body that they're either feeling frail or starting to have some diminished abilities physically or with their thinking. Or even if they're not feeling frail, they're actually physically vulnerable, so they become much more sensitive to, for instance, the effects of medication or anesthesia or the stresses of hospitalizations. Those tend to be a lot harder as people get older. So there's no exact cutoff, but I would say that geriatricians are usually seeing people in their 80s and 90s. Sometimes people in their 70s, if they've developed some advanced chronic illnesses, especially some of the illnesses that are linked with aging, such as Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, or sometimes when people have several chronic illnesses and they're all coming together and they're declining, then the approach of a geriatrician can be especially helpful.
Okay, now you say that they might be particularly vulnerable to the effects of anesthesia. Does that mean they shouldn't have operations? Does that mean they need a longer time to recover from them? How would you deal with that?
Well, we almost never want to say that somebody should or shouldn't have something. Generally, mm-hmm. as people get older, especially if they're not as physically sturdy as they were before, and as we all know, we see some people who seem to physically age a little bit faster than others. But certainly as people become older, it takes them longer to recover, whether it's an injury, anesthesia, a medication side effect. In terms of whether or not to have an operation or anesthesia, in an ideal scenario, before, as one considers the operation, one should consider that one's risk is going to be a little higher. How much higher is something that one should discuss with a doctor or nurse who can sort of help personalize the risk based on the person's age and health status and other medical conditions. And so one wants to consider that risk and weigh it against what the benefits are. Mm-hmm. There are some operations that when we do big clinical trials, such as some operations for back pain, it actually doesn't look like people, on average, who have the surgery do that much better than those who don't. Although in individual cases, some people, it might be a good fit for people. So in that case, if it looks like the chance of really having a lot of benefit is small, but there's a risk of side effects or difficulty with anesthesia, then when you balance the benefit and the risk, maybe it's not worth doing. On the other hand, some operations, such as repairing the hip after a fracture, if they think there's a good chance they can be successful and get the person walking, then that benefit might be worth the risk of becoming confused or having difficulty with the anesthesia after the operation.
But isn't that risk-benefit differential you're talking about? Wouldn't that apply to people across the age spectrum? You have somebody 25 going to have surgery. Wouldn't you also consider risk-benefit?
Well, I think it's good for all patients to learn to ask some, detailed questions about, well, what benefit can I expect from this procedure? And possibly, not just ask the provider, but try to get, a sort of third-party opinion about it. And that was meant to be part of the purpose for these comparative effectiveness research that they've talked about doing. I think as people get older, the risk of side effects or complications goes up, and they may not realize it, and sometimes it's not made entirely clear to them at the time that the operation is being considered. Not all healthcare providers are used to reconsidering what the risk might be for a person who's older. And one of the things we see is that many older people are prescribed medications that, for instance, are on a list of potentially inappropriate medications for people age 65 plus. And I think that just reflects the fact that healthcare providers are busy and they get into certain habits and they may not, always have the time to step back and rethink what they're prescribing. So, mm-hmm. But you're right, everybody should have ideally that kind of individually tailored care, but the more medically complicated and vulnerable people become, the more important that individualized tailoring becomes.
Now, much has been written about young people. I'm talking about people maybe in their teens,
mm-hmm.
having things such as high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, that were thought to be the domain of people a lot older. Will this affect, I mean, eventually if they fall under the care of a geriatrician, will this affect the type of care they need and receive? In other words, if their bodies didn't develop diabetes when they were 65, developed when they were 15, does that make a difference in their whole aging process? Or is that something?
Well, that's an interesting question that, yeah, that researchers are studying. The presumption is that if you develop diseases such as diabetes earlier in life, having that kind of chronic illness puts a certain toll on the body. And so we might expect to see, more impact on the blood vessels, on the heart, on the stroke risk. And so, yeah, that person, when they reach 65 and on Medicare, or if they see a geriatrician later in life, might have more disability and damage to their body than somebody who develops diabetes later in life. But our approach generally in geriatrics is that when we meet somebody, we see where they are at that time, both in terms of their medical condition, but especially in terms of their physical function and their cognitive function. And then we try to figure out, well, what's most important that we can try to improve medically that will help this person live the best life possible at this time.
Now, much of what you're talking about, and I think you know what I'm coming to, revolves around a close professional interaction between the doctor and the patient, you know, determining what is best, looking at each patient individually. If I understand correctly, you have opted out of Medicare because you felt the time constraints didn't make that possible. The more
yes,
personalized
that's right.
care.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I understand what the question is.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
You felt the time constraints of Medicare would not allow for that type of personal interactions?
Right. So Medicare right now, for doctors who are in sort of a conventional fee-for-service environment. And I used to be at a clinic where I was salaried, but the clinic only was paid based on how many people I could see every day. So those visits are short, and that does make it hard to individualize the care and to work collaboratively with a patient and family on finding something that's a good fit for them. And of course, the older people are, the more problems they tend to have, the less time, you know, the more the mismatch between the time available and the needs is. So in terms of the future of Medicare and how to care for an aging population in a way that's compassionate and effective and at a cost we can sustain, it's important to realize that most care, even to very old people in Medicare, I mean people in their 90s or 85 up, which is what the demographers usually consider very old. Most of that care will have to be delivered by just general internists and family practice doctors because there aren't enough geriatricians. So even if we were all willing and able to go on the front line and see people in fee-for-service Medicare, there wouldn't be enough of us. So part of the issue is how do we make it possible for all general internists and family practice doctors to provide older patients with the care they need. And some of that is probably going to mean having either longer visits or now they're moving towards paying doctors not so much based on how many in-person visits you squeeze into a day, but more how well you take care of a panel of patients over time. So that's probably going to result in longer visits. We're moving towards primary care teams, which hopefully will allow physicians to focus on that individualized counseling and decision making. And some of that work can also be done by nurse practitioners or other people on the team. We're moving towards better educational resources for patients and families so that they can take an active role in learning maybe about those risks and benefits before they come in, so that the time in the visit is more focused on sort of reviewing it and helping patients and families make decisions. So so things are changing, but it's important to know that the question is how to make this care doable by all primary care doctors and not just geriatricians, because there aren't enough geriatricians available to provide care to everybody who will need this style of care.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you happen to become a geriatrician?
Most geriatricians went into geriatrics because they especially loved older people. In my case, I went into geriatrics because I was especially interested in how to improve the primary care system for people who are medically complicated, for medically complicated adults. And I met a geriatrician who suggested to me that I consider geriatrics because that's where people have the greatest need for a comprehensive, compassionate, person-centered approach. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I went into it, and in doing that, I discovered that I especially loved working with older people. But I think the training helped, because when one doesn't have the training and the geriatric skill set, it can sometimes be a little bit scary and overwhelming to see an older person in a short visit, because most doctors want to be helpful, and you want to be helpful, and the person comes in and they have so many problems and you don't know where to start. Maybe some of the problems are things that you haven't had enough practice in helping with, like memory problems or dementia. So I'm very grateful to have become a geriatrician, because I feel it made me just a much better general internist, and now I especially enjoy taking care of older patients and helping them and their families with the various challenges of late life, various medical challenges, that is.
You say there's not enough geriatricians. How might medical students or residents be interested in going into that specialty? How could you elicit more interest? Is there a need to elicit more interest?
Well, there's definitely a need to elicit more interest, because right now we only have, I think, one geriatrician for 2,600 Americans age 75 and over.
Wow.
And that's projected to go to, I think, something like one geriatrician for 4,000 Americans age 75 and over. So there's definitely a need. You know, in general, there's been decreased interest in primary care, and one can really think about this care as being a subset of primary care. And primary care doctors are paid less than other doctors, and I think the medical students perceive it as a really difficult, stressful job where you're trying to help people with their care over time. And, you know, if you go into clinic and see doctors scrambling to see 25 people in a day, that might be giving the medical students pause. I mean, it's very rewarding, I find, the work that I do. And it was very stressful when I was trying to see these older patients so quickly, because really they need more than 15 or 20 minutes. But, you know, the exciting thing is that there are real changes underway right now in how we provide primary care. So I think that might help the work seem more appealing to the medical students, because mm-hmm. we do need them to be interested. And even if they don't become geriatricians, everybody, you know, all healthcare providers, unless they're doing pediatrics, need to improve their geriatric skills, because everybody other than the pediatricians will be taking care of more older people, because we have more people coming into Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Now, what you're talking about, sitting down and trying to deal personally with a patient's situation, is very, very different than the medicine you see on TV. Do you think one problem is that even medical students do not have a realistic understanding of the scope of medicine, of what it can be, that they have watched too many medical TV shows or movies themselves? Do you believe that to be one factor?
Well, I think it's certainly possible, but I'm not I don't have a lot of expertise in the sort of research on what shapes medical students, but I suspect that, I know for myself, the experience of residency is a quite powerful one. Right after medical school, you go in for your apprenticeship, and I think what is modeled to residents during your residency makes a lasting impression. And then the medical students, of course, in their third and fourth year, they go onto their clinical rotations, and they work with residents, and they work with doctors in teaching hospitals and teaching clinics. And I think that's probably what's the most powerful thing, is the experience that they have during that third and fourth year of medical school and then during residency. So for me, in internal medicine, you know, we do 3 years of internal medicine, and people have to decide whether they're going to specialize, whether they're going to go into primary care internal medicine, or maybe do geriatrics. And most people in internal medicine end up choosing to specialize and become hospitalists. And I'm sure part of that is just about the experience that they have in residency.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard of Dr. Pearl's and the New England Centenarian Study.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he found that people who live to 100, if you go back, they have consistently aged at a slower time frame. In other words, mm-hmm. there were women who had babies after 40. They were, you know, playing golf at 85. Have mm-hmm. you noticed that among your patients, people who are living into their 90s or even hundreds, they have had what you might call slow aging?
Well, I don't know if I've thought of it as slow aging per se, but they certainly usually have been in pretty good health for much of their life. And so it doesn't seem so surprising that they're still walking around quite comfortably and doing quite well into their late 90s or even 100. So I wouldn't be surprised at the findings. It does seem that some people just genetically have more resilience within their body to all kinds of problems, or they've lived a healthier life, which is, you know, partly about exercise and diet and having meaningful social connections and meaningful work, and, you know, a little bit of stress, but not too much stress. Those are all things that seem to help people thrive and live longer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very, very much for being my guest. And if people would like to reach you to find out more about your practice, how can they do that?
Well, they can visit my website, which is drkernison.net, drkernison.net. And they can learn a little bit about my practice, and I'm also starting a blog for family caregivers, like geriatric tips, since I believe that caregiver empowerment and education is really critical to our national effort to provide good care to people as they get older.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for inviting me to speak on your show.
My name is Harriet Tramer, and I hope you'll join us every Tuesday afternoon at this time when I'm host for Reaching for the Gold. Also, you can find out more about this show by going to bbsradio.com/reachingforthegold. Thank you.